At 8 o'clock Thursday evening, Denny and Trey were playing gin rummy and drinking beer. They stopped, pulled out their stat tracks, pecked in their numbers, and waited. Within seconds, Ahmed chimed in with a clear from Buffalo. Nothing from Mark or Jerry. Mark was supposed to be on a train, enduring the 6-hour ride from Rochester to Penn Station. Jerry was supposed to be in his apartment. The next 5 minutes passed very slowly, or perhaps they raced by. Things weren't clear. The devices were working, right? They were CIA quality and cost a fortune. For two to go silent at the same time meant, well, what did it mean? At 8:06, Denny stood and said,
"Let's take the first few steps. Pack our bags with the essentials and plan to haul ass, okay?"
"Got it,"
Trey replied, obviously concerned. They ran to their rooms and began throwing clothes into duffel bags. A few minutes later, Denny said,
"It's 8:11. I say at 8:20, we're out of here, right?"
"Agreed,"
Trey said as he paused to look at his sat track. Nothing. At 8:20, Denny opened the storage room door and unlocked the gun safe. They stuffed the 5 manuscripts into 2 green army duffels padded with clothing and carried them to Denny's truck. They returned to the cabin to turn off lights and make one last frantic inspection.
"Should we burn it?"
Trey asked.
"Hell no,"
Denny snapped, irritated at his stupidity.
"That'll just attract attention. So they prove we were here. Big deal. We're long gone and there's no sign of the books."
They turned off the lights, locked both doors, and as they stepped off the porch, Denny hesitated a second so Trey could move a step ahead. Then he sprung, slapping both hands tightly around Trey's neck, his thumbs jammed into the carotid pressure points. Trey, older, slightly built, out of shape and unsuspecting, was no match for the ex-ranger's death grip around his neck. He wiggled and flailed for a few seconds, then went limp. Denny tossed him to the ground and took off his belt. 18. He stopped for gas and coffee near Scranton and headed west on Interstate 80. The speed limit was 70 miles per hour. His cruise control was on 68. He'd had a few beers earlier in the evening, but all was clear now. His sat track was on the console, and he glanced at it every mile or so. He knew by now that the screen would remain dark. No one would be checking in. He assumed Mark and Jerry had been nabbed together, and their sat tracks were being taken apart by some very smart people. Trey's was at the bottom of the pond, along with Trey, both waterlogged and already decomposing. If he, Denny, could survive the next 24 hours and get out of the country, the fortune would be his and his alone. At an all-night pancake house, he parked close to the front door and took a table with his truck in sight. He opened his laptop, ordered coffee, asked about Wi-Fi. The girl said of course and gave him the password. He decided to stay for a spell and ordered waffles and bacon. Online, he checked flights out of Pittsburgh and booked one to Chicago and from there a non-stop to Mexico City. He searched for storage units that were climate-controlled and made a list. He ate slowly, ordered more coffee, killed as much time as possible. He pulled up the New York Times and was startled by the lead story, one posted about 4 hours earlier. The headline read, "Princeton Confirms Theft of Fitzgerald Manuscripts." After a day of offering no comments and suspicious denials, officials at the university had finally issued a statement confirming the rumors. On the previous Tuesday night, thieves had broken into the Firestone Library while the campus was responding to 911 reports of an active gunman. It was evidently a diversion, and one that worked. The university would not disclose how much of its Fitzgerald collection had been stolen, only that it was substantial. The FBI was investigating, and so on. Details were scarce. There was no mention of Mark and Jerry. Denny was suddenly anxious and wanted to hit the road. He paid his check, and as he left the restaurant, he dropped his sat track into a waste can outside the front door. There were no more ties to the past. He was alone and free and excited about the turn of events, but also nervous now that the news was breaking. Getting out of the country was imperative.
That was not what he had planned. But things could not be lining up more perfectly. Plans. Nothing ever goes as planned, and the survivors are the ones who can adapt on the fly. Trey was trouble. He would have quickly become a nuisance, then baggage, then a liability. Denny thought of him only in passing now. As darkness began to dissipate and he entered the northern sprawl of Pittsburgh, Denny slammed the door on any memory of Trey. Another perfect crime. At 9 a.m., he walked into the office of the East Mills Secured Storage Operation in the Pittsburgh suburb of Oakmont. He explained to the clerk that he needed to store some fine wine for a few months and was looking for a small space where the temperature and humidity were controlled and monitored. The clerk showed him a 12-by-12 unit on the ground floor. The rate was $250 a month for a minimum of a year. Denny said no thanks, he wouldn't need the space for that long. They agreed on $300 a month for 6 months. He produced a New Jersey driver's license, signed the contract in the name of Paul Rafferty, and paid in cash. He took the key back to the storage unit, unlocked it, set the temperature on 55 degrees and the humidity at 40%, and turned off the light. He walked the hallways, taking note of the surveillance cameras, and eventually left without being seen by the clerk. At 10 a.m., the discount wine warehouse opened, and Denny was its first customer of the day. He paid cash for 4 cases of Rotgut Chardonnay, talked the clerk out of 2 empty cardboard boxes, and left the store. He drove around for half an hour looking for a spot to hide, away from traffic and surveillance cameras. He ran his truck through a cheap car wash and parked by the vacuum machines. This side of paradise and the beautiful and damned fit nicely in one of the empty wine boxes. Tender is the Night and The Last Tycoon were placed in another. Gatsby got a box of his own, once the 12 bottles were removed and left on the rear seat. By 11 o'clock, Denny had hauled the 6 boxes inside the storage unit at East Mills. As he left, he bumped into the clerk and said he'd be back tomorrow with some more wine. Fine, whatever. The clerk couldn't care less. As he drove away, he passed rows and rows of storage units and wondered what other stolen loot could be hidden behind those doors. Probably a lot, but nothing as valuable as his. He drifted through downtown Pittsburgh and finally found a rough section. He parked in front of a pharmacy, one with thick bars over the windows. He rolled down his windows, left the keys in the ignition, left 12 bottles of bad wine on the rear floorboard, grabbed his bag, and walked away. It was almost noon, on a clear and bright fall day, and he felt relatively safe. He found a payphone, called a cab, and waited outside a soul food cafe. 45 minutes later, the cab dropped him off at the departures ramp at Pittsburgh International Airport. He picked up his ticket, eased through security without a hitch, and walked to a coffee shop near his gate. At a newsstand, he bought a New York Times and a Washington Post. On the front page of the Post, below the fold, the headline yelled at him, "Two arrested in Princeton library heist." No photos and no names were given, and it was obvious Princeton and the FBI were trying to control the story. According to the brief article, the two men were picked up in Rochester the day before. The search was on for others involved in the spectacular burglary. 19. While Denny waited for his flight to Chicago, Ahmed caught a flight from Buffalo to Toronto, where he booked a one-way flight to Amsterdam. With 4 hours to kill, he parked himself at the bar in an airport lounge, hid his face behind a menu, and started drinking. 20. The following Monday, Mark Driscoll and Gerald Steengarten waived extradition and were driven to Trenton, New Jersey. They appeared before a federal magistrate, swore in writing that they had no assets, and were assigned counsel. Because of their affinity for fake documents, they were deemed flight risks and denied bail. Another week passed, then a month, and the investigation began losing steam. What at first had looked so promising gradually began to look hopeless. Other than the drop of blood in the photos of the well-disguised thieves, and of course the missing manuscripts, there was no evidence. The burned-out van, their escape vehicle,
was found, but no one knew where it came from. Denny's rented pickup was stolen, stripped, and devoured by a chop shop. He went from Mexico City to Panama, where he had friends who knew how to hide. The evidence was clear that Jerry and Mark had used fake student IDs to visit the library several times. Mark had even posed as a Fitzgerald scholar. On the night of the theft, it was clear the two had entered the library along with a third accomplice, but there was no indication of when or how they left. Without the stolen goods, the U.S. attorney delayed the indictment. Attorneys for Jerry and Mark moved to dismiss the charges, but the judge refused. They stayed in jail, without bail, and without saying a word. The silence held. 3 months after the theft, the U.S. attorney offered Mark the deal of all deals. Spill your guts and walk away. With no criminal record and with no DNA from the crime scene, Mark was the better choice to deal with. Just talk and you're a free man. He declined for two reasons. First, his lawyer assured him the government would have difficulty proving a case at trial, and because of this, he would probably continue to dodge an indictment. Second, and more important, Denny and Trey were out there. That meant the manuscripts were well hidden, and it also meant that retaliation was likely. Furthermore, even if Mark gave them Denny's and Trey's full names, the FBI would have trouble finding them. Obviously, Mark had no idea where the manuscripts were. He knew the locations of the second and third safe houses, but he also knew that in all likelihood, they had not been used. 21. All trails became dead ends. Tips that had at first seemed urgent now faded away. The waiting game began. Whoever had the manuscripts would want money and a lot of it. They would surface eventually, but where? And when? And how much would they want? Chapter 2. The Dealer. 1. When Bruce Cable was 23 years old and still classified as a junior at Auburn, his father died suddenly. The two had been feuding over Bruce's lack of academic progress, and things had gotten so bad that Mr. Cable had threatened more than once to cut young Bruce out of his will. Some ancient relative had made a fortune in gravel, and following bad legal advice, had set up a scheme of misguided and complicated trusts that had strewn money over generations of undeserving kinfolks. The family had for years lived behind the facade of fine wealth while watching it slowly drip away. Threatening to modify wills and trusts was a favorite ploy used against the young, and it had never worked. Mr. Cable, though, died before he made it to his lawyer's office, so Bruce woke up one day with the promise of a quick $300,000, a beautiful windfall, but not quite retirement money. He thought about investing it, and doing so conservatively might net him an annual return of between 5% and 10%, hardly enough to sustain the lifestyle Bruce was suddenly contemplating. Investing in a more daring way would be far riskier, and Bruce really wanted to hang on to the money. It did strange things to him. Perhaps the strangest was his decision to walk away from Auburn after 5 years and never look back. Eventually, a girl enticed him to a Florida beach on Camino Island, a 10-mile-long barrier strip just north of Jacksonville. In a nice condo she was paying for, he spent a month sleeping, drinking beer, strolling in the surf, staring at the Atlantic for hours, and reading War and Peace. He'd been an English major and was bothered by the great books he had never read. To protect the money and hopefully watch it grow, he considered a number of ventures as he roamed the beach. He had wisely kept the news of his good fortune to himself. The money, after all, had been buried for decades. So he was not pestered by friends offering all manner of advice or looking for loans. The girl certainly knew nothing about the money. After a week together, he knew she would soon be history. In no particular order, he thought about investing in a chicken sandwich franchise and some raw Florida land and a condo in a nearby high-rise and several dot-com startups in Silicon Valley and a strip mall in Nashville and so on. He read dozens of financial magazines, and the more he read, the more he realized he had no patience for investing. It was all a hopeless maze of numbers and strategies. There was a reason he'd chosen English over economics. Every other day, he and the girl wandered into the quaint village of Santa Rosa to have lunch in the cafes or drinks in the bars along Main Street. There was a decent bookstore with a coffee shop, and they fell into the habit of settling in with an afternoon latte in the New York Times. The barista was also the owner, an older guy named Tim, and Tim was a chatterbox. One day, he let it slip that he was thinking about selling out and moving to Key West. The following day, Bruce managed to shake the girl and enjoy the latte by himself. He took a seat at the coffee bar and proceeded to prod Tim about his plans for the bookstore. Selling books was a tough business, Tim explained. The big chains were deep discounting all bestsellers, some offering 50% off, and now with the internet and Amazon, folks were shopping from home. In the past 5 years, over 700 independent bookstores had closed. Only a few were making money. The more he talked, the more somber he became.
"Retail is brutal,"
he said at least 3 times.
"And no matter what you do today, you gotta start all over again tomorrow."
Bruce admired his honesty, but questioned his savviness. Was he trying to entice a buyer? Tim said he made decent money with the store. The island had an established literary community, with some active writers, a book festival, and good libraries. Retirees still enjoyed reading and spent money on books. There were about 40,000 permanent residents, plus 1 million tourists each year, so there was plenty of traffic. "What was his price?" Bruce finally asked. Tim said he would take $150,000 cash, no owner financing, with the assumption of the lease of the building. Somewhat timidly, Bruce asked if he could see the store's financials, just the basic balance sheet and profit and loss, nothing complicated. Tim didn't like the idea. He didn't know Bruce and thought the kid was just another 20-something loafing at the beach and spending daddy's money. Tim said,
"Okay, you show me your financials and I'll show you mine."
"Fair enough," said Bruce.
He left, promising to return, but got sidetracked by an idea for a road trip. 3 days later, he said goodbye to the girl and drove to Jacksonville to shop for a new car. He coveted a sparkling new Porsche 911 Carrera, and the fact that he could simply write a check for one made the temptation painful. He stood his ground, though, and after a long day of horse trading, he surrendered his well-used Jeep Cherokee for a brand new one. He might need the space to haul things. The Porsche could always wait, perhaps until he'd earned the money to buy one. With a new set of wheels and money in the bank, Bruce left Florida for a literary adventure that he anticipated more with each passing mile. He had no itinerary. He headed west and planned to one day turn north at the Pacific, then back east, then south. Time meant nothing. There were no deadlines. He searched for independent bookstores, and when he found one, he decamped for a day or two of browsing, drinking coffee, reading, maybe even lunch if the place had a cafe. He usually managed to corner the owners and gently poke around for information. He told them he was thinking about buying a bookstore and, frankly, needed their advice. The responses varied. Most seemed to enjoy their work, even those who were wary of the future. There was great uncertainty in the business, with the chains expanding and the internet filled with unknowns. There were horror stories of established bookshops driven out of business when large discount stores popped up just down the street. Some of the independents, especially those in college towns too small for the chains, appeared to be thriving. Others, even in cities, were practically deserted. A few were new and enthusiastically bucking the trend. The advice was inconsistent and wide-ranging, from the standard, "retail is brutal," to, "go for it, you're only 23 years old." But the one constant was that those giving advice enjoyed what they were doing. They loved books and literature and writers, the whole publishing scene, and they were willing to put in long hours and deal with customers because they considered theirs to be a noble calling. For 2 months, Bruce drifted across the country, zigzagging aimlessly in pursuit of the next independent bookstore.
The owner in one town might know three others across the state, and so on. Bruce consumed gallons of strong coffee, hung out with authors on tour, bought dozens of autographed books, slept in cheap motels, occasionally with another bookworm he'd just met, spent hours with booksellers willing to share their knowledge and advice, sipped a lot of bad wine at signings where only a handful of customers showed up, took hundreds of interior and exterior photographs, took pages of notes, and kept a log. By the time his adventure was over, and he was finished and tired of driving, he had covered almost 8,000 miles in 74 days and visited 61 independent bookstores, no two even remotely similar. He thought he had a plan. He returned to Camino Island and found Tim where he left him, at the coffee bar, sipping espresso and reading a newspaper, looking even more haggard than before. At first, Tim did not remember him, but then Bruce said,
"I was thinking about buying the store a couple of months ago. You were asking $150.
"Sure," Tim said, perking up only slightly. "You find the money?"
"Some of it. I'll write a check today for $100,000 and $25,000 a year from now."
"Nice, but that's 25 short the way I count."
"That's all I have, Tim. Take it or leave it. I've found another store on the market."
Tim thought for a second, then slowly shoved forward his right hand. They shook on the deal. Tim called his lawyer and told him to speed things along. 3 days later, the paperwork was signed and the money changed hands. Bruce closed the store for a month for renovations and used the downtime for a crash course on bookselling. Tim was happy to hang around and share his knowledge on every aspect of the trade, as well as the gossip on customers and most of the other downtown merchants. He had a lot of opinions on most matters, and after a couple of weeks, Bruce was ready for him to leave. On August 1st, 1996, the store reopened with as much fanfare as Bruce could possibly drum up. A nice crowd sipped champagne and beer and listened to reggae and jazz, while Bruce relished the moment. His grand adventure had been launched, and Bay Books, new and rare, was in business. 2. His interest in rare books was accidental. Upon hearing the awful news that his father had dropped dead of a heart attack, Bruce went home to Atlanta. It wasn't really his home. He'd never spent much time there, but rather the current and last home of his father, a man who moved often and usually with a frightening woman in tow. Mr. Cable had married twice, and badly, and had sworn off the institution, but he couldn't seem to exist without the presence of some wretched woman to complicate his life. They were attracted to him because of his apparent wealth, but over time each had realized he was hopelessly scarred by two horrific divorces. Luckily, at least for Bruce, the latest girlfriend had just moved out, and the place was free from prying eyes and hands. Until Bruce arrived. The house, a baffling, cutting-edge pile of steel and glass in a hip section of downtown, had a large studio on the third level where Mr. Cable liked to paint when he wasn't investing. He had never really pursued a career, and since he lived off his inheritance, he had always referred to himself as an investor. Later, he'd turned to painting, but his oils were so dreadful that he'd been shooed away from every gallery in Atlanta. One wall of the studio was covered with books, hundreds of them, and at first, Bruce hardly noticed the collection. He assumed they were just window dressing, another part of the act, another lame effort by his father to seem deep, complicated, and well-read. But upon closer observation, Bruce realized that two shelves held some older books with familiar titles. He began pulling them off the upper shelf one by one and examining them. His casual curiosity quickly turned to something else. The books were all first editions, some autographed by the authors. Joseph Heller's Catch-22, published in 1961. Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead, 1948. John Updike's Rabbit Run, 1960. Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, 1952. Walker Percy's The Moviegoer, 1961. Philip Roth's Goodbye Columbus, 1959. William Styron's The Confessions of Nat Turner, 1967. Dashiell Hammett's The Maltese Falcon, 1929. Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, 1965. And J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye, 1951. After the first dozen or so, Bruce began placing the books on a table rather than returning them to the shelves. His initial curiosity was overwhelmed by a heady wave of excitement, then greed. On the lower shelf, he ran across books and authors he'd never heard of, until he made an even more startling discovery. Hidden behind a thick three-volume biography of Churchill were four books: William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, 1929, Steinbeck's Cup of Gold, 1929, F. Scott Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise, 1920, and Ernest Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms, 1929. All were first editions in excellent condition and signed by the authors. Bruce fished around some more, found nothing else of interest, then fell into his father's old recliner and stared at the wall of books. Sitting there, in a house he'd never really known, looking at wretched oils done by an artist with an obvious lack of talent, wondering where the books came from, and pondering what he would do when Molly, his sister, arrived and they would be expected to plan a funeral service, Bruce was struck by how little he knew about his late father. And why should he know more? His father had never spent time with him. Mr. Cable shipped Bruce off to boarding school when he was 14. During the summers, the kid was sent to a sailing camp for 6 weeks and a dude ranch for 6 more, anything to keep him away from home. Bruce knew of nothing his father enjoyed collecting other than a string of miserable women. Mr. Cable played golf and tennis and traveled, but never with Bruce and his sister, always with the latest girlfriend. So where did the books come from? How long had he been collecting them? Were there old invoices lying around? Written proof of their existence? Would the executor of his father's estate be required to lump them in with his other assets and give them, along with the bulk, to Emory University? Leaving the bulk of the estate to Emory was something else that irked Bruce. His father had talked about it occasionally without giving too many details. Mr. Cable was of the lofty opinion that his money should be invested in education and not left for children to squander. On several occasions, Bruce had been tempted to remind his father that he'd spent his entire life pissing away money earned by someone else, but squabbling over such matters would not benefit Bruce. At that moment, he really wanted those books. He decided to keep 18 of the best and leave the rest behind. If he got greedy and left gaps, someone might notice. He fit them neatly in a cardboard box that had once held a case of wine. His father had battled the bottle for years and finally reached a truce that allowed him a few glasses of red wine each night. There were several empty boxes in the garage. Bruce spent hours rearranging the shelves to give the impression that nothing was missing. And who would know? As far as he knew, Molly read nothing and, more important, avoided their father because she hated his girlfriends. To Bruce's knowledge, Molly had never spent a night in the house. She would know nothing of her father's personal effects. However, 2 months later, she asked him on the phone if he knew anything about Daddy's old books. Bruce assured her he knew nothing. He waited until dark and carried the box to his Jeep. There were at least 3 surveillance cameras watching the patio, driveway, and garage, and if anyone asked questions, he would simply say he was taking away some of his own stuff. Videos, CDs, whatever. If the executor of the estate later asked about the missing first editions, Bruce would, of course, know nothing. Go quiz the housekeeper. As things evolved, it was the perfect crime, if indeed it was a crime at all. Bruce really didn't think so. In his opinion, he should be receiving far more. Thanks to thick wills and family lawyers, his father's estate was wrapped up efficiently, and his library was never mentioned. Bruce Cable's unplanned entry into the world of rare books was off to a fine start. He plunged himself into the study of the trade and realized that the value of his first collection, the 18 taken from his father's house, was around $200,000. He was afraid to sell the books, though, afraid someone somewhere might recognize one and ask questions. Since he did not know how his father had gained possession of the books, it was best to wait. Allow some time to pass, for memories to fade. As he would quickly learn in the business, patience was imperative. 3. The building was on the corner of 3rd and Main Street in the heart of Santa Rosa. It was 100 years old, and originally built to house the town's leading bank, one that collapsed in the Depression. Then it was a pharmacy, then another bank, then a bookshop. The second floor stored boxes and trunks and file cabinets, all laden with dust and utterly worthless. Up there, Bruce managed to stake out a claim, clear some space, throw up a couple of walls, move in a bed, and call it an apartment. He lived there for the first 10 years Bay Books was in business. When he wasn't downstairs peddling books, he was upstairs clearing, cleaning, painting, renovating, and eventually decorating. The bookstore's first month was August 1996. After the wine and cheese opening, the place was busy for a few days, but the curiosity began to wear off. The traffic slowed considerably. After 3 weeks in business, Bruce was beginning to wonder if he'd blundered badly. August saw a net profit of only $2,000, and Bruce was ready to panic. It was, after all, the high season for tourism on Camino Island. He decided to begin discounting, something the majority of independent owners advised against. Big new releases and bestsellers were marked down 25%. He pushed the closing time back from 7 to 9 and put in 15 hours a day. He worked the front like a politician, memorizing the names of the regular customers and noting what they bought. He was soon an accomplished barista. He could brew an espresso while hustling to the front to check out a customer. He removed shelves of old books, mainly classics that were not too popular, and put in a small cafe. Closing time went from 9 to 10. He cranked out dozens of handwritten notes to customers and to writers and booksellers he'd met on his coast-to-coast adventure. At midnight, he was often at the computer, updating the Bay Books newsletter. He wrestled with the idea of opening on Sunday, something most of the independents did. He didn't want to because he needed the rest, and he was also afraid of possible backlash. Camino Island was in the Bible Belt. One could easily walk to a dozen churches from the bookstore. But it was also a vacation spot, and almost none of the tourists seemed interested in Sunday morning worship. So in September, he said to hell with it, and opened at 9 a.m. Sunday with the New York Times, Washington Post, Boston Globe, and Chicago Tribune hot off the press, along with fresh chicken biscuits from a cafe 3 doors down. By the third Sunday, the place was packed. The store netted $4,000 in September and October, and doubled that after 6 months. Bruce stopped worrying. Within a year, Bay Books was the hub of downtown, by far the busiest store. Publishers and sales reps succumbed to his constant badgering and began to include Camino Island on author tours. Bruce joined the American Booksellers Association and immersed himself in its causes, issues, and committees. In the winter of 1997, at an ABA convention, he met Stephen King and convinced him to pop over for a book party. Mr. King signed for 9 hours as fans waited in lines that wrapped around the block. The store sold 2,200 copies of his various titles and grossed $70,000 in sales. It was a glorious day that put Bay Books on the map. 3 years later, it was voted Best Independent Bookstore in Florida, and in 2004, Publishers Weekly named it Bookstore of the Year. In 2005, after 9 hard years in the trenches, Bruce Cable was elected to the ABA Board of Directors. 4. By then, Bruce was quite the figure around town. He owned a dozen seersucker suits, each a different shade or color, and he wore one every day, along with a starched white shirt with a spread collar and a loud bow tie, usually either red or yellow. His ensemble was completed with a pair of dirty buckskins, no socks. He never wore socks, not even in January when the temperatures dipped into the 40s. His hair was thick and wavy, and he wore it long, almost to his shoulders. He shaved once a week on Sunday morning. By the time he was 30, some gray was working itself into the picture, a few whiskers and a few strands of the long hair, and it was quite becoming. Each day when things slowed a bit in the store, Bruce hit the street. He walked to the post office and flirted with the clerks. He went to the bank and flirted with the tellers. If a new retail shop opened downtown, Bruce was there for the grand opening, and he returned soon afterward to flirt with the salesgirls. Lunch was a major production for Bruce, and he dined out 6 days a week, always with someone else so he could write it off as a business expense. When a new cafe opened, Bruce was first in line, sampling everything on the menu and flirting with the waitresses. He usually drank a bottle of wine for lunch and slept it off with a little siesta in the upstairs apartment. Often, with Bruce, there was a fine line between flirting and stalking. He had an eye for the ladies, as they did for him, and he played the game beautifully. He hit pay dirt when Bay Books became a popular stop on the author circuit. Half the writers who came to town were women, most under 40, all obviously away from home, most of them single and traveling alone and looking for some fun. They were easy and willing targets when they arrived at the bookstore and stepped into his world. After a reading and signing session, then a long dinner, they often retired to the apartment upstairs with Bruce for a deeper search for human emotion. He had his favorites, especially two young ladies who were doing well with erotic mysteries, and they published every year. Despite his efforts to carefully groom his image as a well-read playboy, Bruce was, at his core, an ambitious businessman. The store provided a healthy income, but that was not by accident. Regardless of how late his night had been, he was at the store before 7 each morning, in shorts and a t-shirt, unloading and unboxing books, stocking shelves, taking inventory, even sweeping the floors. He loved the feel and smell of new books as they came out of the box. He found the perfect spot for each new edition. He touched every book that came into the store, and sadly, every book that was reboxed and returned to the publisher for credit. He hated returns, and viewed each one as a failure, a missed opportunity. He purged the inventory of stuff that didn't sell, and after a few years settled on about 12,000 titles. Sections of the store were cramped spaces with saggy old shelves and books stacked on the floors, but Bruce knew where to find anything. After all, he had carefully placed them all. At 8:45 each morning, he hurried upstairs to the apartment, showered and changed into his seersucker of the day, and at precisely 9 a.m., he opened the doors and greeted his customers. He rarely took a day off. For Bruce, the idea of a vacation was a trip to New England to meet antiquarian book dealers in their old, dusty shops and talk about the market. He loved rare books, especially those by 20th-century American authors, and he collected them with a passion. His collection grew primarily because he wanted to buy so much, but also because he found it painful to sell anything. He was a dealer, for sure, but one who always bought and almost never sold. The 18 of Daddy's old books he'd filched became a wonderful foundation, and by the time Bruce was 40 years old, he valued his rare collection at $2 million. 5. While he served on the ABA board, the owner of his building died. Bruce bought it from the estate and began expanding the store. He shrunk the size of his apartment and moved the coffee bar and cafe to the second floor. He knocked out a wall and doubled the size of his children's section. On Saturday mornings, the store was filled with kids buying books and listening to story time while their young moms were upstairs sipping lattes under the watchful eye of the friendly owner. His rare book section received a lot of his attention. On the main floor, he knocked out another wall and built a first editions room with handsome oak shelves, paneling, and expensive rugs. He built a vault in the basement to protect his rarest books. After 10 years of apartment living, Bruce was ready for something grander. He'd kept his eye on several of the old Victorians in historic downtown Santa Rosa, and had even made offers to purchase two of them. In both cases, he failed to offer enough, and the homes quickly sold to other buyers. The magnificent homes, built by turn-of-the-century railroad magnates and shippers and doctors and politicians, were beautifully preserved and sat timelessly on streets shaded with ancient oaks and Spanish moss. When Mrs. Marchbanks died at the age of 103, Bruce approached her daughter, age 81 and living in Texas. He paid too much for the house, but then he was determined not to lose a third time. 2 blocks north and 3 blocks east of the store, the Marchbanks house was built in 1890 by a doctor as a gift to his pretty new wife and had been in the family ever since. It was huge, over 8,000 square feet sprawled over 4 levels, with a soaring tower on the south side and a turret on the north, and a sweeping veranda wrapped around the ground floor. It had a roof deck, a variety of gables, fish-scale shingles, and bay windows, many of which were adorned with stained glass. It covered a small corner lot that was lined with white picket fences and shaded by 3 ancient oaks and Spanish moss. Bruce found the interior depressing, with its dark wood floors, even darker painted walls, well-worn rugs, sagging, dusty drapes, and abundance of brown brick hearths. Much of the furniture came with the deal, and he immediately began selling it. The ancient rugs that were not too threadbare were moved to the bookstore and added decades to its ambiance. The old drapes and curtains were worthless and thrown away. When the house was empty, he hired a paint crew that spent 2 months brightening up the interior walls. When they were gone, he hired a local artisan who spent another 2 months refinishing every square inch of the oak and heart pine flooring. He bought the house because its systems worked: plumbing, electrical, water, heating, and air. He had neither the patience nor the stomach for a renovation, one that would virtually bankrupt a new buyer. He had little talent with a hammer and better ways to spend his time. For the next year, he continued to live in his apartment above the store as he pondered the furnishing and decorating of the house. It sat empty, bright and beautiful, while the task of molding it into his livable space became intimidating. It was a majestic example of Victorian architecture and thoroughly unsuited for the modern and minimalist decor he preferred. He considered the period pieces fussy and frilly and just not his style. What was wrong with having a grand old home that stayed true to its origins, at least on the outside, while jazzing up the interior with modern furniture and art? Something was not right with that, though, and he became handcuffed with ideas of a decorating scheme. He walked to the house every day and stood in every room, perplexed and uncertain. Was it becoming his folly? An empty house much too large and complicated for his uncertain tastes? 6. To the rescue came one Noelle Bonnet, a New Orleans antiques dealer who was touring with her latest book, a $50 coffee table tome. He had seen Noelle's publisher's catalog months earlier and was captivated by her photograph. Doing his homework, as always, he learned that she was 37 years old, divorced with no kids, a native of New Orleans, though her mother was French, and well-regarded as an expert on Provençal antiques. Her shop was on Royal Street in the quarter, and according to her bio, she spent half the year in southern and southwest France scouring for old furniture. She had published 2 previous books on the subject, and Bruce studied both of them. This was a habit, if not a calling. His store did 2 and sometimes 3 signing events each week, and by the time an author arrived, Bruce had read everything he or she had published. He read voraciously, and while he preferred novels by living authors, people he could meet, promote, befriend, and follow, he also devoured biographies, self-help, cookbooks, histories, anything and everything. It was the least he could do. He admired all writers, and if one took the time to visit his store and have dinner and drinks and so on, then he was determined to be able to discuss his or her works. He read deep into the night and often fell asleep with an open book in the bed. He read early in the morning, alone in the store with strong coffee, long before it opened if he wasn't packing and unpacking. He read constantly throughout the day, and over time developed the curious routine of standing in the same spot by a front window, near the biographies, leaning casually on a full-sized wood sculpture of a Timucuan Indian chief, sipping espresso nonstop, with one eye on the page and the other on the front door. He greeted customers, found books for them, chatted with anyone who wanted to chat, occasionally helped at the coffee bar or front register when things were busy, but always eased back to his spot by the chief, where he picked up his book and resumed his reading. He claimed to average 4 books per week, and no one doubted this. If a prospective clerk did not read at least 2 per week, there was no job offer. At any rate, Noel Bonnet's visit was a great success, if not for the revenue it generated, then certainly for its lasting impact on Bruce and Bay Books. The attraction was mutual, immediate, and intense. After a quick, even abbreviated dinner, they retired to his apartment upstairs and enjoyed one hell of a romp. Claiming to be ill, she canceled the rest of her tour and stayed in town for a week. On the third day, Bruce walked her over to the Marchbanks house and proudly displayed his trophy. Noel was overwhelmed. For a world-class designer, decorator, dealer, the presentation of 8,000 square feet of empty floors and walls behind the facade of such a grand Victorian was breathtaking. As they drifted from room to room, she began having visions of how each should be painted, wallpapered, and furnished. Bruce offered a couple of modest suggestions, such as a big screen TV here and pool table over there, but these were not well received. The artist was at work, suddenly painting on a canvas with no borders. Noel spent the following day alone in the house, measuring and photographing and simply sitting in its vast emptiness. Bruce tended the store, thoroughly smitten with her, but also having the first tremors of a pending financial nightmare. She cajoled him into leaving the store over the weekend, and they flew to New Orleans. She walked him through her stylish, though cluttered, store, where every table, lamp, four-poster bed, chest, chaise, trunk, rug, commode, and armoire not only had rich origins in some Provençal village, but was destined for the perfect spot in the Marchbanks house. They roamed the French Quarter, dined in her favorite local bistros, hung out with her friends, spent plenty of time in bed, and after 3 days, Bruce flew home alone, exhausted, but also, for the first time, admittedly in love. Damn the expense. Noel Bonnet was a woman he could not live without. 7. A week later, a large truck arrived in Santa Rosa and parked in front of the Marchbanks house. The following day, Noel was there directing the movers. Bruce walked back and forth from the store, watching with great interest and a touch of trepidation. The artist was lost in her own creative world, buzzing from room to room, moving each piece at least 3 times and realizing she needed more. A second truck arrived not long after the first one left. Bruce, walking back to the store, mumbled to himself that there could be little left in her shop on Royal Street. Over dinner that night, she confirmed this and begged him to leave for France in just a few days for another shopping adventure. He declined, saying he had some important authors on the way and had to tend to the store. That night, they slept in the house for the first time, in a wrought-iron contraption of a bed she had found near Avignon, where she kept a small apartment. Every stick of furniture, every accessory, every rug and pot and painting had a history, and her love for the stuff was contagious. Early the following morning, they sipped coffee on the back porch and talked about the future, which at the moment was uncertain. She had her life in New Orleans, and he had his on the island, and neither seemed suited for a long, permanent relationship that involved pulling up stakes. It was awkward, and they soon changed the subject. Bruce admitted he'd never been to France, and they began planning a vacation there. Not long after Noel left town, the first invoice arrived. It came with a note, handwritten in her beautiful script, in which she explained that she was foregoing her usual markup and basically selling the stuff at cost. "Thank God for small miracles," he mumbled. "And now she's headed back to France for more." She returned to New Orleans from Avignon 3 days before Hurricane Katrina. Neither her store in the French Quarter nor her apartment in the Garden District was damaged, but the city was mortally wounded. She locked her doors and fled to Camino Island, where Bruce was waiting to soothe and calm her. For days, they watched the horror on television. The flooded streets, the floating bodies, the oil-stained waters, the frantic flight of half the population, the panicked rescue workers, the bumbling politicians. Noelle doubted she could return. She wasn't sure she wanted to. Gradually, she began to talk of relocating. About half of her customers were from New Orleans, and with so many of them now in exile, she was worried about her business. The other half was spread throughout the country. Her reputation was wide and well-known, and she shipped antiques everywhere. Her website was a success. Her books were popular, and many of her fans were serious collectors. With Bruce's gentle prodding, she convinced herself she could move her business to the island and not only rebuild what had been lost, but prosper. 6 weeks after the storm, Noelle signed a lease for a small space on Main Street in Santa Rosa, 3 doors down from Bay Books. She closed her shop on Royal Street and moved what was left of her inventory to her new store, Noelle's Provence. When a new shipment from France arrived, she opened the doors with a champagne and caviar party, and Bruce helped her work the crowd. She had a great idea for a new book, The Transformation of the Marchbanks House as it filled up with Provençal antiques. She had photographed the home extensively as it sat empty, and now she would document her triumphant renovation. Bruce doubted the book would sell enough to cover its costs, but what the hell? Whatever Noelle wanted. At some point, the invoices had stopped arriving. Timidly, he broached this subject, and she explained with great drama that he was now getting the ultimate discount. Her. He might own the house, but everything in it would be theirs together. 8. In April 2006, they spent 2 weeks in the south of France. Using her apartment in Avignon as home base, they roamed from village to village, market to market, eating food that Bruce had only seen photos of, drinking great local wines not available back home, staying in quaint hotels, seeing the sights, catching up with her friends, and, of course, loading up with more inventory for her store. Bruce, always the researcher, thrust himself into the world of rustic French furniture and artifacts, and could soon spot a bargain. They were in Nice when they decided to get married, right then and there. Chapter 3. The Recruit. 1. On a perfect spring day in late April, Mercer Mann walked with some anxiety across the Chapel Hill campus of the University of North Carolina. She had agreed to meet a stranger for a quick lunch, but only because of the prospect of a job. Her current one, adjunct professor of freshman literature, would expire in 2 weeks, courtesy of budget cuts brought on by a state legislature dominated by those rabid about tax and spending cuts. She had lobbied hard for a new contract, but didn't get one. She would soon be out of work, still in debt, homeless, and out of print. She was 31 years old, quite single, and, well, her life was not exactly going as planned. The first email, one of two from the stranger, a Donna Watson, had arrived the day before and had been about as vague as an email could be. Ms. Watson claimed to be a consultant hired by a private academy to locate a new teacher of creative writing for high school seniors. She was in the area and could meet for coffee. The salary was in the range of $75,000 a year, on the high side, but the school's headmaster loved literature and was determined to hire a teacher who had actually published a novel or two. Mercer had one novel under her belt, along with a collection of stories. The salary was indeed impressive and more than she was currently making. No other details were offered. Mercer responded favorably and asked a few questions about the school, specifically what was its name and where was it located. The second email was only slightly less vague than the first, but did reveal the school to be in New England. And the meeting over coffee had been elevated to a quick lunch. Could Mercer meet her at a place called Spanky's, just off campus on Franklin Street at noon? Mercer was ashamed to admit that at the moment, the idea of a nice lunch was more appealing than that of teaching a bunch of privileged high school seniors. In spite of the lofty salary, the job was definitely a step down. She had arrived in Chapel Hill 3 years earlier with the intention of throwing herself into teaching while, and much more important, finishing her current novel. 3 years later, she was being terminated, and the novel was as unfinished as it had been when she arrived in Chapel Hill. As soon as she walked into the restaurant, a well-dressed and perfectly put-together woman of about 50 waved her over, thrust out a hand, and said, "I'm Donna Watson. Nice to meet you." Mercer sat across the table and thanked her for the invitation. A waiter dropped menus on the table. Without wasting any time, Donna Watson became someone else. She said, "I must tell you that I'm here under false pretenses, okay? My name is not Donna Watson, but Elaine Shelby. I work for a company based in Bethesda." Mercer gave her a blank look, glanced away, looked back, and tried gamely to think of an appropriate response. Elaine pressed on. "I lied. I apologize, and I promise I will not lie again. However, I'm serious about lunch, and I'm getting the checks, so please hear me out." "I suppose you have a good reason for lying," Mercer said cautiously. "A very good one. And if you'll forgive this one offense and hear me out, I promise I can explain." Mercer shrugged and said, "I'm hungry, so I'll just listen until I'm not hungry anymore, and if by then you haven't cleared things up, I'll take a walk." Elaine flashed a smile that anyone would trust. She had dark eyes and dark skin, maybe of some Middle Eastern extraction, possibly Italian or Greek, Mercer thought, though her accent was Upper Midwest, definitely American. Her short gray hair was cut in a style so smart that a couple of men had already looked twice. She was a beautiful woman and impeccably dressed, far out of place among the casual college crowd. She said, "Though I didn't lie about the job, that's why I'm here, to convince you to take a job, one with better terms and benefits than I put in the email." "Doing what?" "Writing. Finishing your novel."
"Which one?"
The waiter was back, and they quickly ordered matching grilled chicken salads with sparkling water. He snatched the menus, disappeared, and after a pause, Mercer said,
"I'm listening."
"It's a long story."
"Let's start with the obvious challenge. You."
"Okay. I work for a company that specializes in security and investigations. An established company that you've never heard of because we don't advertise, don't have a website."
"We're getting nowhere."
"Please, hang on. It gets better. 6 months ago, a gang of thieves stole the Fitzgerald manuscripts from the Firestone Library at Princeton. Two were caught and are still in jail, waiting. The others have disappeared. The manuscripts have not been found."
Mercer nodded and said, "It was widely reported."
"It was. The manuscripts, all five of them, were insured by our client, a large private company that insures art and treasures and rare assets. I doubt you've heard of it either."
"I don't follow insurance companies."
"Lucky you. Anyway, we have been digging for 6 months, working closely with the FBI and its rare asset recovery unit. The pressure is on because in 6 months our client will be forced to write a check to Princeton for $25 million. Princeton really doesn't want the money, it wants the manuscripts, which, as you might guess, are priceless. We've had a few leads, but nothing exciting until now. Luckily, there aren't too many players in the murky world of stolen books and manuscripts, and we think we might have picked up the trail of a particular dealer."
The waiter set a tall bottle of Pellegrino between them with two glasses with ice and lemon. When he left, Elaine continued,
"It's someone you may know."
Mercer stared at her, offered half a grunt, shrugged, and said, "That would be a shock."
"You have a long history with Camino Island. You spent summers there as a kid with your grandmother in her beach cottage."
"How do you know this?"
"You've written about it."
Mercer sighed and grabbed the bottle. She slowly filled both glasses as her mind spun away.
"Let me guess. You've read everything I've written."
"No, just everything you've published. It's part of our preparation and it's been quite enjoyable."
"Thanks. Sorry there hasn't been more." You're young and talented and just getting started. Let's hear it. Let's see if you've done your homework.
Gladly. Your first novel, October Rain, was published by Newcomb Press in 2008 when you were only 24 years old. Its sales were respectable, 8,000 copies in hardback, double that in paper, a few e-books. Not exactly a bestseller, but the critics loved it.
The Kiss of Death.